Welcome to Dancin' Moon Songcast. I'm Scott Simpson, casting from Dancin' Moon Studio in Spearfish Canyon on the north end of the Black Hills of South Dakota, right on the banks of the Spearfish Creek. If you'd like to follow along, you can download a free PDF of my lyric book from scottsimpsonmusic.com/lyrics. And of course, you can find links to all my music there as well. So let's get casting and find out what song we're going to talk about this time. Well, this is the last episode that we'll be putting out in the year 2020. We're nearing the end of our 10-week poetry series, taking a look at, as opposed to what we usually do, which is take a look at songs and songwriting. We're taking a look at some poetry from a collection called Selected Poems, 1989 to 2009 of mine. Today we're gonna wrap things up for 2020 with three poems dealing with something near and dear to my heart, and that is teaching. All three of these poems have to do with either teaching or being a teacher or the process of learning. Some ideas around that. We've talked a little bit about some of this before with some other poems, but we're just taking it head on in all three poems this time. So this first one is a poem called Birthright. Birthright. Jacob stole his birthright, being clever and tricky, and gets the bad rap on account of greed. But what about the sin of Esau, who sold his birthright for a single bowl of soup? Sure, at the time it seemed reasonable, Esau seeing nothing but his hunger, gut-wrenching hunger. But emptiness doesn't always render us clear of sight. Sometimes it shapes desperate eyes and snatching hands. I imagine Esau there at table, hunger sated, realizing now the emptiness of the bowl, the emptiness, what he'd given up. Or maybe not. Maybe Esau simply belched and excused himself, because satiation doesn't always render us mindful of consequence. Keep brother stuffed. He'll never know he's being taken. And sometimes my own hunger is the voice I hear telling me to short sell for a few immediate spoonfuls. I have seen the children of stolen birthrights. Stolen in the end by their feeders, by those who have something to sell them and something to gain from the selling. And I'm a teacher, for heaven's sake, with a bowl of soup and some hungry students willing to eat what I'm dishing up indiscriminately, filling the pits of swollen bellies with what's been mandated, with what the research says will surely fill them. And I could spend days feeding them data soup chock full of standards and a warm broth of best practice, and we could raise the bar, make AYP incentivize the path till no one's left behind. But what if something has been squandered while I was ladling? What if they've traded some blood right, some unique mark? What if we educators have helped them trade a birthright for a bowl of compliance soup? So, few years ago, maybe around the time I wrote this poem, actually, I wrote a little article that I never really sought out publishing about creating a culture of compliance. And it's informed my work. I work now as a consultant who works with schools and districts around the region on various things. But I suppose my time as a teacher and my time as a student deeply informed this delicate dance that we do between true learning and I guess what I'd call manipulating toward compliance. You know, teachers are in a tough position. They're doing something most often because they feel a high calling to be a teacher, a high calling to improve the lives of their students, but also to improve society as a whole, to do things that make and create opportunities for better human beings, for a better society, for a better world, with better artists and better writers and better scientists and better mathematicians and better business people and better people just in general, just helping young people learn. And that's why teachers do what they do most often. But at the same time, they have a very real set of needs, the need to be employed, the need to eat and to have shelter for themselves and their families, their spouses, their children. And the educational system has a responsibility to hold educators accountable. But the tools that they have are clumsy tools. They're clumsy tools because they're tools of reward and punishment quite often. And so accountability becomes this frightful, fear-inducing thing. And therefore, you know, we actually use the word compliance, whether or not a school district is in compliance, you know, with federal or state mandates for education. The problem with compliance is it abandons the heart. The problem with compliance is it abandons, as the poem suggests, something that is a birthright, something that is born within, what is most true about me. If I'm just being compliant, even if I'm being perfectly compliant, I'm going along. The idea of compliance means I'm going along. Not that I'm transformed, not that I'm acting out of some central character of my own, or some central birthright, God-given element of my being, but that I am, I've figured out what the rules are, and I'm toeing the line. And what happens with that? We do it, you know, as in the story of Jacob and Esau. You know, if you've read the story in the Old Testament, Esau is really hungry, and in the moment of being hungry, his brother recognizes, hey, you know, he's really hungry. If I offer him some soup for his inheritance, right now at the moment, he'll probably give it to me. And that's the epitome of leverage. And unfortunately, we sometimes leverage in schools. We leverage job and salary to get teachers to do what we want them to do. And then teachers in turn sometimes leverage grades, rewards, punishments, etc., to get students to be compliant, because we all have to be compliant. And we have to ask, what is lost? What is lost in that teacher who is compliant? He or she is doing what they're told to do by the books. What are they not doing? What beautiful, amazing, professional and creative capacity that makes them fundamentally a wonderful teacher? What elements of that are they giving up in order to be compliant? You see, because compliance doesn't necessarily mean I'm being a great teacher. It means I'm being a compliant employee. But that may be very different from being a great teacher. And maybe I'm sacrificing the great teacher I am in order to be compliant. And then let's look at the classroom level, our students. I know students who go through high school with straight A's because they've learned compliance. They've learned to give the teacher exactly what he or she wants. And they take great pride in it. And they're very good at that. And then they graduate, you know, top of their class, and they go to college. And suddenly, the professors at college aren't asking them for compliance. They're asking them for creativity. They're asking them to think creatively outside of the box, or to problem solve in creative ways. And they've never done that, because they came up through a system that valued compliance over true learning, true inquiry. And so what have they sacrificed? What wonderful thing have they sacrificed? Because we made them hungry for the rewards, we made them fearful of the punishments. And they sacrificed who they were. They sacrificed the amazing artist they would have been. They sacrificed the incredible scientist they would have become in order to toe the line for us and get straight A's. And I'm painting a pretty dim picture right now. We're actually going to move eventually towards some positive things in education. But I think taking a realistic look at the problems that we have, and this problem I think is fundamental in many of our schools. It is so difficult to move out of a culture of compliance and into a true culture of learning and inquiry. It takes respect for educators and respect for students, learners, and that we're all working as human beings in this thing together. So there we have it, our first poem, Birthright. This next one is more less about teaching and learning and more about being a teacher. And I'll say this, being a teacher on a particularly bad day. Okay. I just want to preface it that way. I am a teacher. I've always been a teacher. I come from a family of teachers. I don't want any teachers listening to this to say, wow, he really hates education and teaching. I don't. I love it deeply. I have a lover's quarrel with teaching, though. I see all of its faults. I see all of our problems, and I want to call them out and get them fixed. So this is called Humpty. Humpty. That afternoon, he'd been stripped, not so much like a banana or an antique chair, but quite like some kind of ice sculpture, having yet the chainsaw grooves to prove the artist's process. Fresh from the freezer, unsheeted for show. He was now gathering into a puddle under his own feet, and the hors d'oeuvres were warming, infinitesimal buzzing of flies, cheese darkening ever so slightly. Rot's a process, like stripping, only rather than disambiguation, rotting obscures, like a peach in the windowsill, forgotten, and now no longer a peach, but a hard lump of a sow's severed ear. Not hearing, of course, but also never to be a silk purse. Whether he was coming clear or perhaps growing mold, he was not certain, though he knew he was in control neither of their eyes nor curious hands. The innocent are always intrigued toward tactile amusements, groping and fondling the frosty surface, leaving little fingerprint windows to the soul. But curiosity, as they say, kills catastrophically, beatifically, in a swirl of red. And he knew, as the world tilted, it was he himself askew, and not the snot-nosed toddler in the smart blazer, his mum, releasing only one brief cry before the shattering moment. The tremble of cocktail sauce simultaneously flipped and letting bright droplets. At their feet, his integrity scattered into gritty stones, like safety glass or human teeth on the floorboard of the fatal automobile accident beneath the still bleeding passenger. He knew even the jaws of life could not speak the pieces back into what he dreamed himself to be. Well, I promised we weren't going to stay dark this entire time, but we got maybe a few shades darker here. So let's set this into context. I'm an introvert, and there are many, many teachers, many, many educators who are introverts, and they're wonderful teachers, and there's nothing inherently better about extroversion or introversion. They both have their sets of wonderful qualities and blessings and challenges. But there are some particular challenges for a teacher or an educator who is an introvert. And one of those is at the end of any given day full of teaching, the introverted teacher needs to find a cave to crawl into. Because the process of being a teacher, no matter what age level you're teaching at, the process of being a teacher is the process of being on display. And if you're a successful teacher, and you're not simply moving a lot of students toward compliance, which we talked about in the previous poem. What that means is you are piquing their curiosity, both their curiosity about whatever subject you're studying, but also their curiosity about you as their teacher, as their mentor, as the model for learning that is being held up in front of them. They want to know. If you go into teaching and you want to somehow keep your privacy, somehow hide your true self, somehow keep that separated from your students, you're doomed because they will work and work you until they get something authentic. They want to see who it is who has been set before them. Of course they do. They need to know if they can trust you. They need to know if you're the real deal. But that takes its toll, especially. It takes its toll on everyone, but especially if you're an introvert. It takes its toll. And so you feel, you feel at the end of the day, like this ice sculpture that has been melting all day long and is transparent and has had little fingerprints all over it. Fingerprints that not only melt it away, but also open up for the peering eye, open up windows to what's going on deep inside. And the occasional times when a student asks just the right question or pushes just the wrong button and you come apart. And I've come apart a few times with students. I've come apart. If you're human, that's going to happen. But one of the things that that quite often happens is you demonstrate for your students how short you fall from reaching the level that you aspire to. We teach what we aspire to. We teach aspirationally, and yet we fail very humanly. We fail. We fall short. We make mistakes, and we make them while on display to the younger people who are looking up to us in one way or another. And some of those younger people are genuinely wonderful in their empathy for us. And that's nice. And others are looking for those flaws. And that's very human as well. And so this is a poem. Taking on the Humpty Dumpty sitting on the wall. Had a great fall, but they couldn't put him back together. Well, Humpty in this poem does have this great fall. And the metaphor becomes a car crash. And he knows that even the jaws of life could not speak the pieces back into what he dreamed himself to be. I work with teachers all the time. And there is this gap, and we sometimes refer to it as the tragic gap between where we are and what we know is possible. And so many teachers are dealing with that tragic gap, both with the reality of the teaching and the school that they're in and the communities that they're serving, but also within themselves, the tragic gap between where I'm at, what I'm capable of doing, where my limitations fall, and where I see and aspire to and know is possible, could be possible, were there the hours in the day and the energy to get there, you know. And so you have to make, to be a teacher for very long, not to be a human being. We'll broaden it out too. I know it's not just a matter of teaching. Teaching's what I know, so that's what I talk about. But you know that will be the case. as a human being trying to do good in the world, that you will have to deal with the good that you failed to do, the distance you fell short in various ways. And I suppose, as we started out with talking about being an introvert, one gift of introversion is being only one step away from deep reflection at any given moment. And so that reflective process certainly is helpful in all of this, but it also can sometimes pour salt in the wound. I can get reflective about what I've done or what I haven't done, and that can very easily stop me in my tracks for a good long time. So, here we go. Humpty. Now, I did say that things were going to move in a less dark way, a more positive direction, and they are. We'll wrap up with one more poem in this episode about teaching. This poem is titled "Grass Clippings Like Tea Leaves." Grass clippings like tea leaves. Today I'm reading the future from yesterday, laid out in sun-blanched clumps, where mower blades have battled these less than civil blades and won. This neat appearance almost argues design as giver rather than taker. But fastidious reason is no creator. It offers mere pruning. The mower has cut things short for a season, and this grass will never come to head, produce seed. Above us, the book cliffs slice late morning, shadow bleeding into this valley. My students sprawl upon the soccer field with journals and seedling ideas riding the sharp tips of their burrowing pens. We hear the mower still at work. Who can say, no more, growth stops here? Only the tiniest ant working deep among the hidden roots is safe from the whirring of the blades. But for these 20 minutes, this young sun, these credulous pens, tilling naive pages, we are all taller. So my passion in teaching was teaching creative writing and finding ways to invite students into opening themselves up in writing, capturing ideas and images and being open to fresh things that might come in and being less critical, being less ready to prune everything back and stop and say, what am I supposed to write? As compliance would have us do. Trying to get them to open up to the universe, to their own experience, to their own ideas, to their own histories, to whatever brings idea, even random stuff in the universe that pops in and knocks us in a certain direction and causes something lovely and beautiful to happen. So I took my students on one of the days. when I was teaching in Grand Junction, Colorado, the book cliffs stand above Grand Junction, and they're mentioned in this poem. I did this for 1 year, teaching high school again for 1 year, and we dedicated one day out of the week to creative writing. In every class that I taught, I was teaching a number of different classes, but we broke out the journals and prompts and did stuff one day a week with every class. And this particular day was beautiful outside, so we went outside onto the soccer field, which had just been mowed, and the grass was laid over, of course, and it was all sort of neat. And I had this thought about who decides when it's time to mow and what, and how we go about homogenizing and making sure all the grass is just so. And who gets to do that for these students? Who gets to say this much growth and then no more? This is where we cut it off. This is where it ends. Here's where it stops. We have curricula that give us, where to begin, where to end, how to check off the box that says they've mastered this, they've mastered that, and lists of all the standards that need to be mastered. But who gives permission? Who's the teacher who gives permission to burst on past that, to just go where you go, to find your way, to discover the best route to growth? And that's a hard thing. That's a hard thing. And that's, honestly, that's why we took in my class one day out of the week to do something that didn't have real distinct, exact objectives. And that one day a week was where some students flourished and some floundered. Why would a student flounder with that kind of freedom? Well, if you're used to a system of compliance that tells you this is what you need to do, this far and no further, when you get to this point, you're done. Congratulations, go on home. If you're used to that kind of system, then you flounder when you've got freedom. You flounder when someone's saying, fly, but they're not giving you step-by-step instructions. And that's a challenge. And it's what some students hunger for their entire lives as they go through school, and it's what others fear most. And so then when you provide an experience like this for students, you have to know which students are ready for it and which ones are going to be scared to death of it. And I'm not sure I knew that as well as I should. That's a place where I fell short. I'm sure that these days that I provided them worked really well. I know they worked really well for some students, for maybe even the majority of students. And I know it was frightening for some, because they were being asked to do something that came out of them, not just to memorize for something for a test or to remember the rote steps in a process or something like that. And some of them made real discoveries. Some of them made real discoveries. And some of them planted seeds that might not come up for a while. And I think that's the best we can hope to do as educators. to create an opportunity and an environment that invites amazingness, and know that some will fly and some will flounder and struggle, and we've got to be ready to be there with them, giving them support until they can fly. And many, if not most, will not uncover the ultimate fruit of their learning. They will merely plant the seeds. The fruit, what they've learned, what they've discovered, what they've grown into, that may not be visible for a number of years, till long after they're gone from my classroom, from my school. Because those, quite often, not always, but quite often, those who we praise during their high school years often are those who are very good at compliance. They may not be the ones who set the world on fire 10 years later or 20 years later and do unbelievable things. But it's impossible to know all of that. Grass clippings like tea leaves. Well, there we have it. Three poems about teaching, being a teacher, learning, being a learner, all those wonderful things. That's kind of how we're ending our set of 2020 episodes. Don't worry, though. We'll be back next week with the very first of our 2021 episodes. I appreciate you joining me. I appreciate we're a year and a half or so into this thing. So it's been a wonderful journey for me, and I appreciate those who are going along for the ride. You can find, of course, all of my music and all of my lyrics at scottsimpsonmusic.com. You'll also find that I have a brand new album that's just about to come out, January 15th, 2021, Keys to My Head, a collection of 12 new songs, and I'm super excited about that. I've got some other exciting things going as well. As soon as we finish this poetry series, we will jump into a series where we'll take a look at each one of those 12 songs from Keys to My Head. So I'm excited to talk about those. I'm just all about that right at the moment. So I hope that I hope that you've had a good 2020. I know it's been a strange 2020. I know also that there have been, as we were just talking, seeds planted that are seeds of good things. And I hope, my hope for you is that you'll harvest a lot of those wonderful things in 2021 as we move maybe inch by inch, gradually, toward a sense of slightly more normalcy, or what we like to call normalcy. At least being able to see and touch and hug the people that we love a little bit more than we have in 2020. So that's my wish for you. Stay tuned and be well.